Let's do a little test on the sound. That sounds, I think we're okay, right? Very good. Thank you. Well, I'm going to give a little report of what my ministry has been all about the past couple of weeks. But I thought I'd begin by just asking you. I was here, 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago. How many of you have done your homework? Fantastic. Okay, good. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But what's amazing is that I'm now reaching many more people through the internet than I am in my speaking and in writing. And two things that happened, well, I actually did several radio programs and internet things, but one was with a Muslim who's turned an atheist, and he has a very popular podcast. And so he had me on for 75 minutes. At the very end, he said, you know, I feel like a failure because everything, I crammed for a whole week in preparation for this interview, and I feel like a failure because everything I brought up you had a good answer for. So, and I said, well, that's how things, you said, don't feel like a failure. In science, we often make progress by finding out what does not work. And I said, that's actually my story. I didn't start with Christianity. I started with Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, figured out. And see, when you eliminate things, that actually helps you in the pathway to truth. And I said, one thing I appreciate about you, you're really curious. Keep that curiosity. Keep searching. But test everything you search for. So we'll see. I think he's eager to do it again. And that just this past Friday, it was a 3.5-hour marathon with two atheists. They're Hollywood comedians. And they have, again, a real popular podcast. And so what was really interesting is that they really had me on to talk about the supernatural. And they did this thing with the Ouija board, and they claimed we proved there was nothing to it. And, there's nothing to worry about in astrology or with UFOs. That was what they really wanted to talk to me about. But they began by bashing Genesis. And it's like, last week, I was in a mega church in Detroit, the Detroit suburbs, and I was speaking on Genesis, saying, you know, this is where the atheists go. They really look at this as the Achilles heel of the Christian faith, the first couple of chapters of Genesis. And, that's exactly what happened with these atheists. And they kept insisting that, creation day 4 is a killer for anybody who believes the Bible is the Word of God, because they said it explicitly states that God created the sun on the fourth day. And I said, that just proves the Bible got it dead wrong. But I'd be curious. I mean, they're going to post it. It's not posted yet. It just got recorded on Friday. But I'd be curious as to how some of you would respond, because that happens again and again and again. That's probably the most frequent challenge I get from people who think that the Bible is not the inspired, inerrant Word of God. They say creation day 4 is really the big problem. In fact, there's a Christian who wrote an entire book on creation day 4, and years after he wrote the book, he abandoned the Christian faith, basically because of his inability to resolve what it says. And, you know, it's verse 14, where it basically says, let there be the great lights, so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. So God made the sun, moon, and stars. And people look at that and say, well, the text is the same, that God made the sun, moon, and stars. Now, my first response with these two atheists is, have you read the whole chapter? Okay? Rather than just isolate that verse. But I don't want to steal your thunder, because I really want all of you to be prepared when that challenge comes up. Because I can tell you, it comes up again and again and again. So, anybody? You're running into a friend who says, there's no way the Bible is the inspired Word of God. Look what it says about creation day 4. Wow, look at all the hands that are coming up. Okay, all right. Well, it'd be good, I mean, to think about it. But the reason why I'm bringing it up, I want all of you, and I'm including everybody on the internet that's watching this. And by the way, if internet people want to jump in, they can. But I think it's important that you be ready anytime this comes up, because it will come up, and you need to be ready. I could have told them, look, give me 2 weeks to study it, and I'll come back. But no, I have studied it. I've written on it. But I want, my goal is that every Christian be equipped to answer that question. Yeah. Well, we need a microphone for you. Okay. Let's bring the microphone over.
There's a book someone wrote called Navigating Genesis. I think the author was Hugh Ross, if I remember right. And, no harm in having a few of those, ready to hand out to people. And teaching a course, there's a course that can be taught with it, too, if you can get them there.
Okay, that's one good answer. What I always say to ladies, pack a big purse, because you want to be able to put books in that purse. And guys, have a briefcase with you and have books there. I mean, I always carry books with me, because there are times when somebody raises a question like that and says, here's a book, chapter 15, that answers that specific question. But it's always good to be able to respond verbal. What I like to do is give them a verbal answer that's brief and say, if you want the whole story, if you want the documentation, the citations, here's a book, then hand them the book. And say, when you're done with it, see if you can find someone you can give it to. Okay, anyone else? Yes, over here. Got the microphone.
Whenever I come across that question, I tell people, have you read the whole chapter? And it's important to go back to when God created light. And it's important to understand that he made the atmosphere translucent. And later on, he makes it transparent, which is what we see in verse 14. And once they understand that, they understand, they were there all along.
Okay, very good. Take them back to creation day one. Creation day one says, let there be light. And what does it say before that? Verse Genesis 1:2, it says it's dark on the surface of the waters. Now, it's interesting with these two atheists, and I think they got this from Christians, because there's a certain segment of the Christian community that has this belief that what was happening is that God shone light upon the earth and did that for the first three creation days. Then on day four, he created the sun, and he took away his light. I hear Christians saying that, and these guys, I think they were just, taking this from people they had heard. What's wrong with that interpretation of Genesis 1? We're going to get you a microphone.
It's ignoring the frame of reference. It's like you've taught the Spirit of God was brooding over the waters after you're being told that the surface of the earth is a water world and dark. And so all these references to light in the day accounts are to a surface observer. So I think the first thing to unhinge is the perception that people have a modern bias, and to tell them they have a modern bias when they're reading the text, that they go to space first because we know space, we've been in it, we've all seen pictures of it. But for a biblical audience who's never left the planet, or at least never seen pictures taken by somebody else who did, their immediate bias, and to point out that they have a bias of interpretation, that the text is written to somebody who would know, as they do, references from space, but it's not. And so if you have to take the frame of reference and then judge the text, it starts a different process going. And that they might have a bias in interpreting is a very important thing that most people, you have to go there first before they would realize they could be mistaken.
Well, that's exactly the mistake these two atheists were making. And, I spoke on Genesis 1 when I was in this church in the Detroit suburbs. And what I told the audience was this. If you remember nothing else from my message, remember the frame of reference for the creation days is an observer on the surface of the earth, below the clouds, not above the clouds. Because the mistake that these atheists were making is that they thought the Bible was saying there was no light at all in the universe anywhere until creation day one. But what does the text say? It says, let there be light. It doesn't say that God created the light. When did God create the light? Anyone? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. A common error I hear, too, is people thinking that phrase, God created the heavens and the earth, means that God, the Bible is saying, God made the universe and the earth at the same time. And I said, well, I saw that when I first picked up the Bible, and I said, I wonder what these heavens and earth are. And I was basically saying, you need to be curious. It's like you immediately jump to this conclusion that the text is saying that God created the universe and the earth at the same time. Shouldn't you at least see if that interpretation stands up as you continue through the Bible? And you continue through the Bible, you discover not once in the Old Testament do you see the word universe. You do see it in the New Testament. Greek has a word for the universe. In biblical Hebrew, there is no word for universe. They have this phrase, the heavens and the earth. It's used 9 times in the Old Testament. And if you look at those other 8 texts outside of Genesis 1:1, they're referring to the totality of physical reality. So get your mind off planet Earth, get your mind off galaxies. The text is saying this is when God created all matter, energy, space, and time. And this is sustained by a parallel passage you see in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 3, which basically says, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. We can detect matter, energy, space, and time. So it's consistent with what the Old Testament says. But if you're not curious, I mean, you know, if all you do is you look at that one passage and don't scratch your head and say, I wonder what this is all about. And what I was sharing with these atheists, too, is that when I picked up these different holy books, Hindu Vedas, the Quran, the Mormon text, Baha'i, etc., I made a commitment that I would read them in the best possible interpretive light. Whereas what I was seeing from these atheists is they were looking at the Bible in the worst possible interpretive light. And if you do that, every book is filled with errors and mistakes. But what's interesting to me is even if you put the Hindu Vedas in the best possible interpretive light, it violates what we know to be true from history and geography and especially from science. It doesn't pass the test. But if you put the Bible in the best possible interpretive light, which means I wonder what these heavens and earth are. I wonder why it says create in Genesis 1:1 and why it says let there be in Genesis 1:3. So the fact that it uses a different verb tells us that God's implying this is not when he first created light. It's the first time light shows up on the surface of the earth. And, you know, there's a parallel text that talks about creation day one. Elsewhere in the Old Testament. Anybody know? In the book of Job, chapter 38, it tells us that God had blanketed the waters of the earth with clouds that kept the waters dark. So in Job 38, 8 and 9, it's explicit about why it's dark on the surface of the waters. I found that these atheists were not aware that Job predates Genesis. Because again, they would bring up the whole point, you know, well, why didn't the author of Genesis give us all these scientific details that are so important for us to understand what's going on? And it says, well, if you look at Job, what you're asking for is already there. You know, there's a huge controversy at seminaries about creation day two. But if you look at the 6 days of creation, the briefest statement of all is on creation day two. It's just a single short sentence. But the reason why Moses could get away with just a short sentence is because Job 37 and 38 give you a chapter and a half on creation day two. So no need to repeat it. The people already had that. And now I got called on this. The atheist says, well, what evidence do you have that Job predates Genesis? We've been there in this class. Remember 4 years ago we discussed this? Maybe yeah. Hey, anybody remember? What is the evidence that the content of Job predates that of Genesis? There are no what? Very good. I'll repeat that since we didn't get the microphone back to Steve. But when you look at the book of Job, who's doing the animal sacrifices? Not the priests. It's the patriarchs, which basically tells us that the content is in the patriarchal era rather than the priestly era. Because when you get into the Torah, it's the priests that are doing the sacrifices. And so that's one piece of evidence. Another piece of evidence is this is a time when you don't yet have nations. Because you look at Job as simply referring to small city-states. So that tells us we're looking at a time when you don't have organized nations like you did at the time of the Torah. And I think one other thing that I think tells us is when you look at Job, it's written in a poetry that's designed to be memorized word for word. And so it would be the way to communicate a book of the Bible before Hebrew became a written language. Because yes, there's good evidence that Hebrew did not become a written language until the 15th century B.C. And so we're talking 400 or 500 years before that. You would need a vehicle whereby the content could be preserved by word-for-word memorization. Now, I run into people in the 21st century who say, you've got to be kidding. Memorize the entire book of Job word-for-word? Well, that's because you don't have to remember anything these days. If you want to remember something, just go to the internet. It's right there. Or you've got these smartphone devices that remember for you. Or you've got hard drives. I think people living in the 21st century have got the least capability of memorization of any generation that's ever lived. The reason why it's difficult for us to memorize, we have no compelling reason to memorize. So, but those of you that are my age can probably remember back to the 1960s and 50s, where when you went to public school, they made you memorize thousands of lines of Shakespeare's plays. And I can't remember them today because I don't use them. But, you know, you can do that. And Muslims today memorize the entire Quran word for word. I mean, if you're a dedicated Muslim, that's one of the things you're supposed to do is memorize the whole book word for word. And that's way bigger than the book of Job. So memorizing the book of Job isn't that bad. And by the way, it's a good exercise. In this class, I've been teaching this class for over 40 years, but when we're back in those days, we actually had an exercise where I challenged all of you, pick one book of the Bible and memorize it word for word. And you got 1 week to do it. So I told them, no fair picking those little short epistles by John at the end. You know, pick something that's got more than one chapter in it. So a lot of people pick the book of Titus because that's just 3 chapters. But hey, the whole idea is you can do it. And that's part of meditating upon God's word. But back to the text. What about this fourth day? Okay. Got a microphone for Steve here.
Question for you. Well, just a comment. Context, day three is important. I think those 3 types of plants are very rudimentary plants. And they needed light. You've lived in British Columbia. I've lived in Seattle. And it's one of the greenest places on earth. So there are cloud covers for a full month sometimes without the sun.
Well, Steve, after we resolved the fourth day, these atheists jumped to the third day.
Okay.
And it was really interesting where they thought the text was talking really advanced vegetation.
That's important.
It is?
Yeah.
But I told them, look, it begins with let the land produce deshev. It's a very generic word for vegetation.
Right.
And it says here are 3 examples. And it says, you think it's an exhaustive list. It's not. It's just 3 examples. And it's the context of what happens on the planet. And also that those Hebrew words there are more generic than they are in English. And so we got through that, just looking at that. But their big hang-up was creation day 4, insisting this is where the sun is first created according to the Bible.
So after that comment, I have a question for you. In verse 17, it says, the lights were set in the firmament. Have you had many people challenge you on the word set?
Yes. One thing we talked about with these atheists was looking at that text and basically making the point. The ancients weren't stupid. Okay? The idea that you could have a realm with no sun and have plants. I mean, even the ancients realized that's an issue. And it's interesting talking to these atheists. They says, well, you know, we've heard young Earth creationists say that you can easily have plants surviving for 24 hours without the sun. And I says, look, people living 3,000-4,000 years ago were well aware, take away the heat of the sun, those plants aren't going to make it for a second. So the young Earth interpretation doesn't solve the problem. But the whole point is the ancients weren't that stupid. They knew how crucial both the heat and the light of the sun were. They also knew that the stars were set in the heavens. And what they meant by that is that they could see that the sun would move relative to the background stars. But what they saw in the constellations was a fixity. Now, they knew that the Earth was rotating. And again, I mean, this idea that the ancients thought that the world was flat, that they didn't know it was a sphere, they didn't know the sun was the center of the solar system. If you actually look into their literature, they knew that the sun was much, much bigger than the Earth. And they knew the Earth was a sphere. They knew the approximate distances. They knew the stars were bodies just like the sun, because they actually tried to measure motion in the stars, and they couldn't measure it. So that's kind of where the set thing comes. The stars don't move if you look at them with the naked eye. With a telescope, you can see very tiny movements, but with the naked eye, you can't. Now, they could see that the planets were moving, and that the sun and moon apparently move relative to the background stars, but the stars are fixed. They really are set from a naked eye point of view. So, but that I think is important to bring up. I think in the 21st century, we really think that people 3,000 and 4,000 years ago were much more poorly educated than we are. Now you say, how did the ancients figure all this out? Well, number one, they would look at lunar eclipses. When you look at a lunar eclipse, the partial eclipse of the moon by the shadow of the Earth, what shape is that shadow? It's a circle. It's always a circle. If it's always a circle, that implies that the Earth is a sphere. Because if it's a disk or flat in some way, it won't always be circular. But if it's always circular, they were actually able to measure the degree of circularity, and they're able to do that to get an idea of how far away the moon was. And also, they were able to look at the sun shining down into a deep well. In fact, there was a bunch of Egyptian astronomers who basically looked at the shadow of the sun on June 21st. They knew June 21st was a time when the Earth was tilted more towards the sun in the northern hemisphere. And so on that day, they would measure the angle of the shadow of sunlight going down a deep well. And then they would go down 800 miles south and measure the shadow there. And the difference in the two angles they used to determine how big the Earth was. And they were able to measure the diameter of the Earth to about 1% precision by that technique. This was done 3,000 years ago, 2 to 3,000 years ago. They were able to do this. So they knew the size of the Earth. And once knowing the size of the Earth, they could get an idea of the size of the moon. And I also find that a lot of people in the 21st century, I mean, you've probably heard of this idea that the flat Earth idea is back. People are actually believing that the world is flat. And I joke with people that the easiest proof against a flat Earth, if the Earth was flat, cats would have knocked everything off the edge. But what I'm finding is people have forgotten their high school geometry. High school geometry, you have those triangle theorems. And one of the most important one is if you know the length of the base and you know the angles of an isosceles triangle, you can determine the distance or the length up to the vertex. That's how we measure the distances to stars and the moon and the sun and the planets, is that you get a baseline along the Earth and you can measure the angle that observer A sees and observer B sees. And the ancients also figured out that in terms of trying to look at the stars, is that if you, because they determine roughly the orbit of the Earth about the sun and determine, well, that gives you a baseline of 186 million miles. And so they would make a measurement in the wintertime and a measurement in the summertime, looking at the angle towards the star, and what they discovered was the angle was the same according to naked eye observations. And that's how they concluded that stars have to be extremely distant because we can't measure the angles of the... They both measure to be 90 degrees. And if they measure to be 90 degrees, that means a vertex is way, way off in the distance. And that's how they determined these stars had to be bodies just like the sun. And in fact, I wrote an article on our reasons.org website where astronomers looked into the astronomical records of the ancient Egyptians on Algol. That's the second brightest star in the constellation Perseus, and it's a variable star. And it's a variable star because you've got two stars orbiting one another. And the period has actually changed. But what gave astronomers a really good insight is those ancient Egyptian measurements were 3,000 years ago. And they were so careful in their measurements, they were able to determine the period of the orbit to better than four places of the decimal. And so we took their, because that's because they observed it every night. They observed it every night for a couple of centuries, and so they were able to come up with a very accurate measurement. They actually understood if you get 1,000 measurements, you can reduce the error by a factor of 10. And so even though all they were using was naked eye measurements, they were able to come up with a very precise timing of the orbit of the star Algol. We compared it with the orbit we know today. Today we can measure it to six places the decimal. But there's a difference between the Egyptian measurement and the modern day measurement, which told us about the interior physics of the stars, and we were able to come up with a much superior model of the interior physics of the stars because of ancient Egyptian astronomy. Bottom line was, they weren't stupid. And you say, well, how come they came up with this idea that the Earth was the center of the solar system? It's because they didn't have algebra. If you don't have algebra, you can't predict the future positions of the planets from a sun-centered perspective. And so they did it from an Earth-centered perspective and came up with this epicycle model whereby they were able to predict the future positions of the planets. And by the time we had algebra, that was no longer necessary. And you say, well, how did they actually find out? In the Renaissance era, Copernicus, that the sun really is the center of the solar system. And the Ptolemy, the Egyptian astronomer, Greek astronomer, who came up with his Earth-centered idea was wrong. We now know that Ptolemy knew that the sun was the center of the solar system, but he couldn't make the math work. So he did it from an Earth-centered perspective. Copernicus didn't make a discovery. What he did is he went from his home in Poland down to Italy, where there was the libraries where they had preserved these ancient Egyptian and Greek writings. He read those writings and says, the sun is the center of the solar system. And so then he began to write a book basically reviving what had been known 25 or 1,500 years earlier. So Copernicus gets a lot of credit. He deserves credit for going down to those Italian libraries and reading those ancient manuscripts and discovering, you know, they had it right all along. But with algebra, they didn't need to do it from an Earth-centered perspective anymore. Yes, get you a microphone.
I have a book about the Great Pyramid at home, and nobody knew until, I think it was in the 20s, a British pilot was flying over the Great Pyramid at a certain sun angle, and he noticed that the previously thought flat sides actually have a valley from the apex of the pyramid down to the midpoint of each side. And if you measure the eccentricity of that offset where they kinked the line of the base of the pyramid, because the pyramid's height compared to its circumference matches the Earth's center to pole and compared to the circumference around the equator. Those are the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. And that eccentricity of the bases actually matches the number you come up with when you compare the diameter over the poles to the diameter over the equator, which are different.
Well, the Egyptians had these instruments whereby the naked eye, they could measure when the stars would come by at exactly at midnight. they were making measurements and timing that were accurate to a minute, and they were making position measurements that were accurate to 1/15th of the moon diameter, so 2 arc minutes. So, but it was because the Egyptian government actually gave their astronomers 25% of their gross national product to do their astronomical studies. So you might complain about NASA's budget, but it's a lot less than 25% of the gross national product. And a lot of my astronomy peers are quite envious of these ancient Egyptian astronomers that they got that much wealth of the nation to do their astronomy. But it basically makes the point. If they were that interested in the science of the universe, they weren't stupid or ignorant about the science of the universe. And hence they would have, you know, Moses, who was trained in all the sciences of the Egyptians, he wouldn't have been so incredibly ignorant to actually write here and imply that the sun was created on the fourth day. And again, notice the careful use of the verbs. He says, let there be. He doesn't say create. He doesn't say make. Now, where these atheists got off is they say, well, verse 16 says there, so God made the sun, moon, and stars. But verse 14 says, let there be. And so that tells us, and they weren't aware there was no punctuation in the original Hebrew. There's no parentheses, there's no commas, there's no periods. You've got to figure that out. But it says it's not that difficult to figure out. Verse 14 says, let there be. What you get in verse 16 is a clarifying note, basically saying, hey, this is the first time in the text it even mentions the sun, moon, and stars. And it's basically saying, by the way, God made these too. It's not saying that he made them on the fourth day. It is saying that God's responsible for these sun, moon, and stars. It's saying nothing about when God made them. And again, they were not aware that there are no tenses in biblical Hebrew. There are verb forms, but they're not tenses like we have in English that give you explicit indication of the timing of the event. So, but they wound up insisting, hey, this is clear proof that the Bible got it wrong. And it says, nobody believes your interpretation. I said, that's not true. My interpretation of Genesis is not unique to me, because they're saying, well, you're just an astronomer reading this into the text, forcing the text to say this. And I says, well, you're atheist forcing the text to say something I believe it was never intended to say. That was kind of where the debate was going. But the whole point is this will come up again and again, and I encourage you, take time to be ready. Little report on what happened at this church. They told us that they had 15,000 members. Well, 6,500 showed up in person. They have two satellite campuses where they get about 1,000 each, but the really big audience is live streaming, kind of like we do here in this class. A lot of you are here in person, but we got a lot of people that participate through live streaming. And so, but they had me speak on Genesis 1, and the first service, they had me speak 40 minutes, and I said, I'd like to do a Q&A, and he said, well, we've got a Q&A scheduled afterwards. And it was an evening service. So we did a Q&A, and the Q&A went on for an hour. And it was the pastor came up to me and said, tomorrow morning we have the morning services. Can you cut your message to 30 minutes, and we'll have 10 minutes for Q&A right in the service. And after the last service, we'll have an hour plus of additional Q&A. That's what I requested in the beginning. So fortunately, I had a talk already where I could cut it down to 30 minutes and jumped into that. So... and that's something I've been trying to talk to pastors about, is that if you really want to see adult non-Christians come to your church and get engaged, put Q&A into every message you give. And it must be open mic, where you don't screen the questions ahead of time. Now, because of the size of this church, they had everybody text their questions in. But they were just taking them as they come. So, but... that buys a lot of credibility when you're basically saying, we'll take any question, any topic that you raise. And hey, even if it's just a few minutes, it basically communicates to people, we're here to engage, and we're here to dialogue with you on the different issues and debates. And so it's one reason why we encourage questions here in this class, is for that very purpose. By the way, every church I know of where they have open mic, Q&A built in to their worship services, their sermons, is a church that's growing by adult converts. People will come if they know that there's a time to engage. In fact, I run into a lot of skeptics who say, I don't want to go to church. They sing for 30 minutes. I hear a 30-minute message, and there's no chance to ask questions. There's no chance to engage. There's no chance to debate. And the surveys have been done by Barna, basically indicating that the primary reasons why people leave the church and don't return. These are people raised in a Christian family. They go to church. They leave the church and don't return. The top two reasons that they give for leaving the church is their belief that science contradicts the Bible. Number two, no chance to ask questions. Those are the two top reasons. So fortunately, this church back in the Detroit area, they're eager to get science back in, and they're eager to have Q&A sessions. And so we've got to have lengthy Q&A sessions there. The other thing I noticed was typically my book, A Matter of Days, doesn't sell that well. It was selling like hotcakes at this event. And so I was talking to people, because you know, people were having me sign the book, and they were crying. And so I just asked them, what's going on? And they said, well, I have a daughter, and we raised her as a Christian, and she's left the church. And the reason she left the church, she felt that to be a Christian, she had to believe that the universe and earth were only 6,000 years old. And says, we're going to give her this book. Says, you've given us hope that we can have our daughter come back. And I found out that there were dozens of people, parents and grandparents, who were literally buying the book for that very purpose, to try to, you know, build a bridge to bring their grandkids and children back. What also came up in the Q&A time is that they asked me questions about my being on the autistic spectrum disorder. And what I found out later is that this church has a large ministry to autistic kids and the parents of autistic kids. And I got to talk to a lot of the parents afterwards. And that's something that disturbs me, is that we have these parents who are really worried about their kids that are on the spectrum. One of the things I benefited from my parents, they didn't worry about me. And I think that really helped me function, because my parents weren't worried. But there's all these parents that are basically not only worried, but almost terrified that their child is going to basically be non-functional. And I says, they said, well, what was it like? And I said, look, I had all those social handicaps. I'm not denying that. And it's literally taken me decades to deal with those handicaps. I'm still dealing with them right now. But I said, what you need to do as a parent is find out what that special gift is. Because any autistic spectrum disorder child that has a normal IQ or higher will have a special gift. You need to find what that gift is, because that's what's going to give you hope and give your child hope. And if you don't find that, they're not going to be motivated to deal with their social dysfunctions. You need to give them some hope. And they said, well, how do you do that? And I says, well, expose your 8-year-old to college-level material in a variety of subjects and see what clicks. And it's like, they never even thought of it. I said, did your parents do that? And they said, no. But what my parents did at age 7, they taught me how I can take a bus to the big library in downtown Vancouver that had 3 million volumes. And so I had to take 3 different buses to get there. And they let me go there. And I just, you know, kind of surveyed it myself and came home with 5 books on physics and astronomy. I was 7. Well, this is where times have changed. In the 21st century, you would be considered to be a bad parent if you let your 7-year-old all by himself take 3 buses to get downtown and go to the library. You have to go with him. I mean, today we really protect our children. Now, I can tell you maybe my parents overdid it, because this library was in a really bad part of the city. But I didn't know any better, so I just went there every weekend and brought home a bunch of books. So I found it on my own, but it was basically my parents giving me permission to go ahead and do this. But I said, you can be proactive and just, you know, get these books. And what you need to do is don't force them to read it. Just leave it lying around. They'll pick it up. That's what happened to me. I found it and just picked it up. So, because sometimes parents are just too pushy. So I said, no, just make the stuff available. And don't panic, don't worry, because your child will react if they see that you're worried and panicked. So what the bottom line is, I think we're going to be able to set up a Zoom meeting where we're going to be able to engage, because apparently they meet on a regular basis. It's a support group, and it's well over 100 different couples that are engaged in trying to help their autistic spectrum disorder children. So I think we're going to be able to set up a meeting where we can basically give them some tips on how to do it, how to react. And because I look at these children personally as a treasure. I mean, it really helped when I shared with parents, you know, do you realize that Mozart was on the spectrum? Einstein was on the spectrum? Where would we be without Mozart and Einstein? And I said, you know, they found, I mean, look how young Mozart was when he started composing, 4 years of age. So find that. Anyway, that was a special treat there to see that going on. Now, last time I was here, and yeah, we are going to get into the homework assignment. I brought all the stuff here. But what happened, I took 3 radio interviews, and just a few days ago I did a TV interview with a Christian Broadcasting Network. Pat Robertson interviewed me. And actually, a newspaper reporter wrote an article that I posted on my Facebook page. But it was something we briefly introduced the last time I was here, and it's become a really big news story. And so let me go to that right now. Maybe you've heard of this. And it's causing all kinds of panic, quite unnecessary, but this is what's going on. A number of papers have been published and promoted in NASA and other websites, basically making the point the magnetic pole is moving and is now moving at a fast rate and it's heading towards Siberia. You ever heard that? I mean, it's making big news lately. And the concern is basically showing you, that little red line is showing you the movement of the magnetic pole over the past 50 years, where now it's really close to the North Pole. And basically saying the fact that it's moving so fast tells us we're headed towards a magnetic reversal. And what I've been getting from these radio talk show hosts and from Pat Robertson and others is this idea this is going to be the end of the world. That with a magnetic reversal, we're going to lose our magnetic field, and we lose our magnetic field, radiation's going to pour in from the sun and from cosmic sources, and it's going to lead to devastating health issues. It's going to ruin our crops. And it's also all going to cause water to begin to leave the earth and desiccate the earth. And that would happen if we lost our magnetic field completely. And what I've been sharing in these interviews, well, it can't be as catastrophic as you think because there's been hundreds of magnetic reversals in the past 500 million years. And, you know, life survived just fine. There's not a single mass extinction event that we can tie to a magnetic reversal. Now, it is true when you get a magnetic reversal, the magnetic field weakens, but it doesn't weaken enough to be the end of our agriculture, to lead to catastrophic incidences of cancer because of radiation from the sun. However, I will share this. It does lead to one major catastrophe because it's going to allow electromagnetic radiation to come in from the sun and the cosmos to such a degree that it could damage our satellite system and it could damage our power grid. Now, if we were living 100 years ago, that would be no concern at all. Lose the power grid, we don't even have a power grid. Lose the satellites, we don't even have any satellites. The problem is today we're very dependent on power grids and satellites. For example, the NASA government agency decided to do a study. What would happen if we had, say, a gigantic solar flare that knocked out the electric power grids of most of the world? And basically it means it would take 2 years to restore those grids. The fact that it would take 2 years rather than a day or two to restore the grids means that you'd have large parts of the world, including large parts of the United States, without electric power for months, and in some cases, more than a year. And what this report pointed out is we can't feed 330 million people without electricity. Take up the power grid, we no longer have the means to preserve food, to refrigerate it. We no longer have the means to transport that food. And we would actually have a problem trying to feed our population. Or we have to force them to go on a subsistence diet. And even calculated, we could be looking at millions of deaths due to starvation as a result. And basically called for, you know what, we need to have plans in place to protect our power grids. And as far as the satellites go, well, you have to put up new satellites. And that could take years, which means you could be without GPS navigation for many months. And as my son shared with me, Dad, if that happens, that is the end of civilization as we know it. So, well, there's actually a paper that was published in the Journal of Science a few months ago noting that the brains of people under the age of 30 in the United States are shrinking in one important capacity. The hippocampus in the brain is where you get your sense of direction. And so normally the older you get, the more your brain shrinks. Sorry for those of you that are getting up there in years, but that's true. As you get older, your brain tends to shrink, not by much, but it does. But the phenomenal thing is they're noticing that people under the age of 30 have a smaller hippocampus than people over the age of 30. That's because they've gotten completely dependent on GPS navigation, where they don't need to use the hippocampus anymore to navigate. And it's just like what happens with your muscles. If you don't use your muscles, they atrophy. If you don't use your brain, it atrophies. So once in a while, put down that smartphone and look at a map and go where you're supposed to go. It will keep your hippocampus going. So, all right. Yes. Yes. Okay. The one flare that has been the cause of quite a bit of alarm is the one that happened in 1859. It's called the Carrington event, named after the physicist that studied the flare event. What it did is it knocked out the telegraph system. Because at that time, we didn't have a power grid, but we had these telegraph systems. And the solar flare caused electricity to run along the telegraph wires and actually electrocuted some of the telegraph operators. Didn't kill him, but it sure gave him a good jolt. Basically shut down a lot of the telegraph communication. It also caused spectacular aurora to be displayed all over the planet. So spectacular that there were miners in Colorado that got up 2 hours early because they thought the sun was coming up. So they were making breakfast 2 hours before dawn because of the bright light of the aurora borealis. But within 2 days, it was all over, and the telegraph system was relatively easy to repair. What this report put out by U.S. government was saying, if that event were to repeat today, the consequences would be far more catastrophic, because of the fact that we have all these systems in place that are very sensitive to these strong pulses of electromagnetic radiation, like our power grids and like our satellite system. So now, the most recent one that happened was in 1989, a much smaller flare than what happened in 1859, but it was a flare big enough to knock out the Quebec power grid and basically caused $13 billion worth of damage. Now, it is such that the Quebec and Canadian governments have taken, by the way, none of the other power grids were impacted. You say, how come Quebec and nowhere else? Well, if you look at this map, Quebec is closest to the North Magnetic Pole. And back in 1889, it was down in northern Canada, not where it is today, and therefore quite close to Quebec. And the closer you are to the North Magnetic Pole, the bigger jolts you're going to get. But it's such that the Canadian government has now put in place a system to protect the Quebec power grid from a similar event. Now, what they put in place is not adequate to protect it from another Carrington event like what happened in 1859. That because they spent $1 billion to protect it from a $13 billion repeat disaster. And they said, given where we are, we think that's a good investment. I totally agree with them. But the study that came out, if a Carrington event were to happen today, irrespective of how many people may die from the lack of electricity, the cost of bringing the system back up to where it is right now, $2 trillion. Now, the cost of protecting the grid from that event, and basically the protection is this. If you walk down your streets, you see these transformers on these poles. You get a Carrington event, it knocks out all those transformers. The problem is the manufacturing capacity we have today to replace those transformers is about 2,000 per month. And incidentally, it's in China. So you need to be replacing millions of those, and it would literally take 2 years to get them all up and running. But what you could do is say, how about if we have an inactive factory in place that's basically ready to go online the moment that happens, where we can actually be turning out 200,000 of those transformers per month and get the system back up and running much more rapidly. Or another solution is, let's just have 1 million of these transformers in protective storage. Put them in a place where electromagnetic pulses can't do them any damage, and when this thing happens, we can get the power grid up in 1 week. I mean, that'd be the wisest thing to do. It would be expensive. It would cost tens of billions of dollars, but it's like an insurance policy against a $2 trillion disaster, and in particular, it's an insurance policy against millions of people dying of starvation or starting to do damage to one another. Because one of the things this report pointed out was that if people are in danger of dying of starvation, people are going to get their shotguns out there and they're going to be protecting their food supply from their neighbors, and that could probably wind up with more devastating consequences than simply the lack of food. So in that sense, I think it's worth doing the investment. And what I can tell you as an astronomer, these things will happen. Now, when are they going to happen? I can't tell you. We do know that one of the good things, by the way, and this is really the point, is this is the best time to have power grids and a GPS satellite system, because the sun right now has the lowest flaring activity it's ever had in its entire history, and in the future the flaring activity will go up. We are living at the optimal flare time history of the sun. And by the way, we're orbiting the best star. Every other star has a much more damaging flaring activity level than our sun does. Our sun is the best, and our sun is at the perfect age where it has that minimal flaring activity. You say, how wide is the window for that minimum flaring activity? It's about 90,000 years wide, and we're right in the middle of that 90,000-year window right now. So you can be praising God that we happen to be created at just the optimal time when civilization is possible. You know, in writing about this, I make the point, I think the creator of Adam and Eve wanted us to eventually develop the high-technology civilization that would enable us to take the gospel message of salvation through Jesus Christ to billions of people quickly rather than slowly. That requires high-technology civilization. That requires that we be protected from these flare events, and we happen to be orbiting the best star at the best possible time. Now, back to this problem of what's going to happen when the pole reverses. Okay, we have a magnetic field because we're orbiting a planet that's got a solid ferrous metal core. Ferrous metals, that's iron, cobalt, and nickel, and they're magnetic. I mean, if you want to get a really strong magnet, you want to get a magnet that's got lots of cobalt and nickel in it, as well as iron. Our core has that, but it's solid, and around it is a liquid core that's also predominantly iron, nickel, and cobalt. But it's liquid, and it's rotating. So it rotates about that solid core, and it's that rotation that generates our magnetic field. Or you can look at it this way. There's a solid core, the outer core. You get the circulation that generates our magnetic field. Now, what has been discovered? This paper just got published, making this point that from 4 billion years ago to 1.7 billion years ago, we had a multipolar magnetic field. You say, what on earth is that? Well, if you pick up a bar magnet, it's got a north pole and a south pole. A multipolar situation is where you got poles all over the place. You got north and south poles all over the place. I'll show you a diagram in a minute. But yeah, from 4 billion years ago to 1.7 billion years ago, we had a magnetic field, but it wasn't bipolar. It was multipolar. And then 1.7 billion years ago to 1 billion years ago, we transitioned to a weak dipolar field. And then from 650 million years ago to the present, we have a strong field. So from 1 billion to 650, the field began to strengthen. And then for the last 650 million years, it's been a strong magnetic field. Now, I'll give you that history because it explains in part why the history of life looks the way it does. The more advanced the life, the more you need to have a strong magnetic field to protect you from the radiation of the sun and cosmic rays. So if you're simply a microbe, a multipolar magnetic field is fine. Yes. Question.
Yes, hi. I don't know why, but do you think there's any connection between this radiation, magnetic field, you know, everything you're speaking about, and let's see, Revelation 16, like 8 and 9, when like it, you know, the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun and it was allowed to scorch people with fire and, you know, that one.
Yeah.
Anything to it?
Well, you'll see that also in Revelation 8, but yeah, Revelation 16 is basically saying there will be a time when people will feel scorching heat from the sun. It's going to be a brief time window. We're talking probably days or weeks, most probably a month, but there will be a period when people will be experiencing the scorching heat. So think of kind of a worldwide heat wave causing this to take place. And there's been a lot of speculation how that could happen. People say, well, maybe more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will lead to that scorching heat. Maybe we knock out the ozone shield. That's going to cause ultraviolet radiation to come in. So, but yeah, rather than the sun changing, there's going to be something in the earth that will change. And you've got a parallel passage in Isaiah 24. It says, a time will come when human beings will pollute themselves to their great harm. So it's basically saying it's going to be human activity that will bring on the scorching heat. One article that was published just, again, a few weeks ago is making the point that we're going to see more heat health issues simply because people are living in crowded, heavily populated cities. If you live in a crowded, heavily populated city, the city generates a heat island. Everybody's got their air conditioner on. People living close together, and there's a lot of electricity being used, and where you've got electricity being used, you're going to have heat being expended. And so there are cities in the world today where the temperature in the downtown area is 10 degrees to 15 degrees warmer than it is outside the suburbs. So you've got these heat islands, and since the majority of the human population lives in those cities, maybe that's how that prophecy and revelation will be fulfilled. The most recent example is that there was a terrible heat wave that hit in downtown Tehran about a year ago, and a lot of people died of heat stroke as a result. So, but there's lots of cities in the world. I mean, here in Los Angeles, it's not quite the same because even though we've got 19 million people in the greater Los Angeles area, we're spread out. But I'm talking about cities where you've got 10 million plus people living in a small area, all running their air conditioners. You're going to get a lot of heat generated. Okay. Yes. Microphone.
We've noticed that when we drive on the freeways, it's always 2 or 3 degrees hotter than as soon as you get a block away from it, it's 2 or 3 degrees cooler.
Well, yeah, because you've got a lot of automobiles.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the rubber makes contact with that concrete, it generates heat.
Mm-hmm.
All that exhaust generates heat.
Yeah.
And maybe all the anger of people not going, getting to where they want to go generates heat. I don't know how much heat comes from road rage. I don't know about you, but I get pretty frustrated trying to drive back home on the 210 freeway. So, okay, let me show you what a magnetic reversal is like. Okay, this is what our magnetic field looks like right now, where the orange lines are our North Pole and the blue lines are the South Pole. Basically making the point it's not as simple as a bar magnet. Notice the jumble of north and south magnetic field lines you have in the middle. But it's such that it approximately acts like a magnet. When you get a magnetic reversal, this is what happens, is that you now get not just one North Pole, but two North Poles, and you can actually get a third North Pole coming out on the left. Same thing with the South Poles. That's basically a multipolar magnetic field. That's the kind of magnetic field we had from 4 billion to 1.7 billion years ago. Now, it is a weaker field, but it doesn't go down to zero. And that's what's generating all the panic. People think we're going to have a magnetic reversal. The magnetic field is going to drop all the way down to zero Gauss. You say, how much does it drop? Well, right now our field is approximately one Gauss. With a magnetic reversal, it could drop anywhere down to 0.05 to 0.40 Gauss. Now, if it's 0.4 Gauss, you're not going to notice anything at all. If it drops down to the minimum, by the way, the minimum is rare. Rarely does it go all the way down to something like 5%. But it even goes down to 5%. It typically stays at 5% for a short period of time, builds up to 10 or 20, and that's enough to protect you. I wrote an article in my blog. I think it's already up on my blog site, basically making the point there was a Harvard astronomer that did an intensive study on this and basically said it's how long the field stays weak. That's really the question. As long as the field is weak for a short period of time, there are no consequences to life on planet Earth, food productivity, or human health. And there's no, you don't need to worry about that radiation desiccating the planet, basically ionizing the water and causing the water to escape to outer space. But he says if it lasts for a long period of time, you do get those devastating consequences. Basically says that explains why Mars did not keep its water. If it did have a magnetic field, it wasn't there for very long, and it stayed weak for a long enough period of time that it lost virtually all of its water, and of course there'd be all that radiation coming in. So this kind of looks like what happens when the reversal begins to come back. And so this is the magnetic field coming out of a reversal, where you now begin to see that a dominant North Pole is forming and a dominant South Pole is forming, and here it's completely out of the reversal. So this is normally what the magnetic field looks like, but yeah, there's been at least 300 magnetic reversals in the last half billion years where you basically go from a dipolar field to a multipolar field, and then the poles flip where you, instead of having north and south, north here and south here, it basically becomes south and north here, and the magnetic field gets restored. Here it shows you the complete reversal sequence, and we're talking about a few centuries to maybe a few thousand years for the reversal to occur, where you go from north at the top and south at the bottom to the opposite, where you got south at the top and north at the bottom. And in between, you basically get the multipolar magnetic field that was predominant in the early history of the Earth. Now, how many planets do we know of that have a magnetic field where you get these reversals that are short-lived? One. Yeah, ours is the only one. That's basically what this astronomer at Harvard was pointing out, is this explains why life is unique to the Earth, because Earth is the only one that has this long-lasting magnetic field where the reversals, and by the way, he was making the point, reversals must happen. Just based on the dynamo of the Earth, you will get these reversals. But they're not going to be damaging to life on Earth. Now, if it were dropped down to 5% and we were to get one of those big solar flares, we'd be in big trouble. Not in big trouble for our health, but in big trouble for our power grids and for our GPS navigation system and maybe a lot of our other computer technology. So I've often been saying maybe we should have backup manual typewriters for our computers. Because, I mean, where can you find a manual typewriter anymore? I mean, we really are dependent on our technology. And I'm not saying that we need to go back to those I don't know. I'm old enough to remember typing on a typewriter. I can type twice as fast on a computer as I can on a typewriter. And moreover, it's easy to fix my mistakes. It's really hard fixing your mistakes on a manual typewriter. Bottom line, and this is what I wrote in my article, we need to protect our technology. Because we do know a magnetic reversal is coming, and there's a risk if the field were to drop down to, the, say, the 5 or 10% level, that a flare could do us some damage. But there are things we can do to protect the system. And we don't have to do anything to protect our health or to protect our crops. They can handle short periods of time with the field. And by the way, a 5% strength field is still a really strong field. Mercury has a magnetic field, but it's less than 1% the field strength of our planet Earth. And so even if we drop down to the 5 or 10% level, comparatively, it ranks as a really strong magnetic field, strong enough to give us the protection we need, but not strong enough to protect our technology. So bottom line, I think our technology is worth protecting. Okay, there's no questions on that. I'm going to jump us into the book of Isaiah. Last chance to ask a question. Yes, microphone.
First of all, how short is short when you're talking about this time that we could have without that protection? Are you talking days, months,
okay, the
years?
Problem with these magnetic reversals, some of them last a long time, and some of them are really short. What do you mean by short? Okay, typically a magnetic reversal that's rapid, we're talking a few centuries. One that's, it can be thousands of years. The longest magnetic reversal, we're talking like a few tens of thousands of years. But it's completely random. You can't tell in advance whether it's going to be quick or it's going to be slow.
Yeah, but you made reference to some time where there was a short period, I can't remember exactly the wording, that a short time where we would be vulnerable, and that is a regular thing.
For example, we could go through magnetic reversal where there's no Carrington events, in which case, you know, we don't really suffer much damage. But the whole point is, with a weaker magnetic field, you're more subject to damage from a really big solar flare. And incidentally, that's also random in the sense that the flare is only going to do its damage if it hits the magnetosphere of the Earth. Solar flares go off in all different directions. Most of the solar flares don't do us any damage at all because they basically are pointed in a different direction. It's only when it happens to be directed right towards the Earth that we get a problem. That's what happened in 1859. It was a head-on collision between a really big solar flare and Earth. And so that's why we had the consequences that we did in 1859. Now, just to scare you a little bit, if you go back to 776, there was a much bigger event than the Carrington event. And so astronomers have basically calculated the probabilities of how frequently these things will happen. Carrington events, you're probably going to get those once every 200 or 300 years. An event like the one in 776, about once every 1,000 or 2,000 years. But the 776 event was 5 times stronger than what happened in 1859. And so that would have huge consequences on the electric power grid systems.
Although we're within that 1,000 to 2,000 period year statistical time
now. We're overdue
now
for both, but again, it's random. You really can't tell when it's going to happen. So who knows? It could be more, it could be less.
So during this reversal, our compasses would not work properly, right? Would I understand that?
The compasses would be a problem because who knows which pole they're pointing towards. By the way, what's good news today, if I can go back to this slide here. This is the time to be using your compasses. Look at how close that magnetic pole, let's see if we can get this back. There it is, okay. I mean, this is the ideal time to be using your compass to find your way around because look how close the magnetic pole is to the rotation axis. So if we were to go back to, say, the 1950s, your compass could be pointing as much as 20 degrees off of true north. But now, no matter where you are in the world, it's pointing really close to true north. So, hey, if you ever lost in the woods, get your compass out. It'll tell you almost exactly where true north is. But wait 50 years, and maybe it won't be so good anymore. So this is the window to be hiking with your compass. We've got a question on the Internet?
Yes, we do. Faith wants to know, what is the reason for the reversals? If you've already answered it,
The reason you get these reversals, and this is what this astronomer at Harvard pointed out in his paper, is the nature of what's going on in the interior of the Earth, where you've got the solid core. If I can bring this one back again, here we go. You've got the solid core, you've got the liquid core, is that the rotation of that liquid core around the solid core varies. So there's some random movement there. And there's also some inhomogeneity in the material there, particularly what's called the boundary between the mantle and the liquid core. And basically that's going to cause disturbances in the dipole field. And so this is what leads to these magnetic reversals. I'd be leading you down the wrong path if I said we totally understand the physics of magnetic reversals. I mean, there's over 200 papers published trying to explain it. We got a basic idea that it's because of what's going on in the liquid core and the liquid core mantle boundary. But we're still trying to figure out exactly what's generating it, because the hope is maybe we can develop a means whereby we can predict. But one thing we do know is when you see that magnetic north moving rapidly on the surface of the Earth that we do now, it's usually a sign that a reversal is coming. However, the majority of what we think are reversals are where the pole moves and then comes back. You get far more what we call partial reversals than we do get complete reversals. A partial reversal is where the pole moves, say, 40 degrees and then comes back. And when that happens, the magnetic field stays strong all the way through. When you get a complete reversal is where the field can weaken down to 5 to 40% of where it is right now. And so this could well be the typical rapid movement, and then it comes back without a complete reversal.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, all right. We may not be getting to Isaiah.
Okay, super quick. Do you think that could lead to... we always have earthquakes, we just do. Their range, you know the range. Up to 9, I guess, is a serious one. Would we get more, less? Have no effect, but it looks like it affects seismic activity.
Yeah, geophysicists don't see a correlation between our magnetic field and the earthquake activity. So, and again, the only real risk is if we have this weaker magnetic field and we happen to be get hit by one of these solar flares. If we're not hit, not too much to worry about. Yes.
In this process of the reversal, while it's going on, does that mean all our technology will be down for a long period of time?
Your technology will be down that is subject to electromagnetic pulses. I mean, your automobile is going to work fine. And chances are your computers will be okay, because chances are your computer's inside a building. Where there's enough metal between you and the building, you get some protection. If your computer is outside, it might get fried. So it's some of our technology be impacted. We know our satellite system is at the highest risk because, you know, it's right there above the... It gets no protection from the atmosphere of the Earth. So that's the highest risk, and our power grid is the next highest. But almost everything else will probably function well as long as we don't get a solar flare like we got in 776. That is 5 times the strength, and that would be much more extensive over. But you're basically looking at your electronic system as taking the biggest hit. So if you happen to be in a hospital where they're doing some imaging on you, maybe there'll be some problems there, but they can just redo the imaging. So
you're out of time.
I'm out of time? Okay. Let me give you a bottom line to this before we close, though. And that is that, when we apply this physics to other planets, we see that this is a big reason why life probably is unique to Earth, or at least advanced life is unique to Earth. because the idea of getting a rocky planet, and this is the whole point, the only other rocky planet we know of that has a magnetic field is Mercury. And it's because Mercury is super dense like the Earth is. If it's super dense, that means you've got to have enough iron, nickel, and the cobalt in the interior that you can generate this magnetic field. But with Mercury, you're getting a magnetic field that's not quite 1% of the Earth's field. The fact that Earth has such a strong magnetic field, in my opinion, is nothing short of a miracle. So I look at this as the handiwork of God has given us this amazing planet, enabling advanced life, not just primitive life, to be able to thrive here. And also that the field has stayed intact for 4 billion years, again, is astounding. It's one thing to have a field that lasts for a few thousand or a few million years, but to have it last for billions of years and to remain strong for those billions of years. That is something, and this is what, the more we study this, the more we're discovering just how complex and fine-tuned it must be. 20 different features of the interior of the Earth have to be fine-tuned to give us the magnetic field we need to have advanced life. I'm going to be putting out a book on that. It's going to be released in 2021. I've just started writing it. It's got a book called Interior Designs. And we're hoping a lot of people will buy it thinking it's going to help them redo their homes. It's got nothing to do with the interior designs of homes or buildings. It's all about the interior design of the Earth, our galaxy, our cluster of galaxies, the moon, etc. But it's basically making the point. We've done all this attention on the design of the surface. There's stuff in the interiors that we're just discovering that has phenomenal level of fine-tuning design. So I've just started that book project. And right now, my wife is editing the book I just finished, the book on climate stability and climate instability. That'll be out within a few months. With that, I'm going to close. By the way, I will give to you again your homework assignment. And if you don't have these, I've brought a whole bunch of them with me. These are all the passages, word for word, in the book of Isaiah that pertain to the Trinity. If you didn't get one of these, please come forward and take one. And what we're going to do next week is break you up into groups where we're going to tackle the question. Group A, look at all these passages and pull out all the ones that refer to God the Father. We're going to have another group that's going to be focusing on all the passages that pertain to God the Son and then God the Spirit. And then we're going to have another group that's going to be focusing on those passages that mention two of those three persons. We're also going to have a group look at the question, because you see this repeatedly in the book of Isaiah. God is one and only one, making repeated emphatic statements of the unity of God. So we're going to have a group focused on that, but we're also going to combine it with groups focusing on the fact, yes, Isaiah says that God is one and only one, but also that it's manifested in three persons. So that'll be the group assignments. And I'd like all of you to at least read through these passages. And I think what's exciting, when you read through all these passages in one sitting, and we're talking 5 or 10 minutes, you walk away saying, how can anyone look at this and not realize that the Bible is claiming that God is a triune being? Because there's a lot of cults that every cult denies the Trinity doctrine of the Bible. Jews deny it. Muslims deny it. But just, this is what is amazing to me. Muslims respect the book of Isaiah. Jews respect the book of Isaiah. These cults respect the book of Isaiah. Look at these texts. And I think that's what hit me, just reading all these verses in one sitting. Wow. Look how explicit and detailed the book of Isaiah is in the Trinity. So yeah, if you don't have one of these, come up and get one. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had looking at these amazing discoveries that have happened literally before.